This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Untik. Jeffrey Kenny is a professor of religious study at DePauw University, where he teaches courses in comparative religious and Islamic studies. His research focuses on modern Islamic thought in Egypt and the Greater Middle East, with a special interest in political religion, radicalism, and Islamist movements. He is the author of Muslim Rebels, Kharijites, and the Politics of Extremism in Egypt, and is more recently a co-editor of Islam in the Modern World. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Let's begin with your background.
Okay.
What got you interested in the study of religion?
I started to read about Islam when I was a senior at university studying philosophy. I was actually studying abroad in Germany at the time, and in the house that I was living, there were three Muslims, two Indonesians, one Palestinian. I just started reading up on it, and when I returned to the States, I decided to shift from philosophy to religious studies. And then I went to the Middle East and started taking Arabic, and pretty soon it's one of those things that you've invested so much time and energy that you're not going back anywhere. So, and I became interested in the, I guess, early origins of religions, the way they develop, and then the way they evolve and redefine themselves over time. So it's kind of a interest in intellectual history, but focused on religion.
So encountering a religion that way, did you find it difficult when you are doing research? And do you face any resistance or difficulty in accessing the religion because you are perceived as an outsider or someone who is a non-Muslim or a convert would feel, for example?
Right. Well, it depends on the people with whom you speak. I think many people that I've spoken to anyway in the Middle East about this, and I'd say even here in Malaysia, I think they're very open and interested just in the fact that I'm interested. It's certainly true that the academic study of religion is very, very different from an insider's perception of it. And so the way I approach the study of religion and the way I analyze religion would be very different from, say, a faith-based knowledge. And I think most believers understand that and they get it. So they wouldn't be coming to me or talking to me about faith issues in terms of they wouldn't come to me for any kind of guidance or insight. And in fact, many Muslims would not think it's appropriate to learn about Islam, even history of Islam, from a non-Muslim. But again, it would depend on the person in the tradition. Some people are more open than others. It depends where one might be on the spectrum of liberal, progressive, or more conservative. But I found people to be very open and willing to share their ideas with me, even though they know I'm not a Muslim myself.
Teaching Islam at an American university, has it gotten difficult? Is it a challenge?
I think it depends on where you are in the States. If you tend to be in areas where there is a greater Muslim population, it can be easier, and in fact, it could be a little bit more difficult. The very first course I taught, Introduction to Islam, I taught in California at Cal State Northridge, and 60% of my students were Muslim students, and another higher percentage were Jewish students. And that kind of keeps you on your toes when you're teaching in front of so many believers who are, of course, in some way looking at you, wondering what you're doing teaching about Islam. Where I'm teaching now, we have very few Muslims, both from the United States or from abroad, who wind up coming to the Midwest to go to school at a small liberal arts college. So it's... But I find that students in general are interested in Islam. And of course, the downside is they've become more interested since 9/11. So their take on this is not necessarily what it might be if they were studying, say, Buddhism or Hinduism. They are often trying to figure out why Muslims do the things that Muslims do. And the doing that they're looking at is typically militancy. And so I think part of my job is to try to get them to look at the larger picture of Islam, Islamic history, Islamic teachings, and to try to get them to see militancy in its context and not as a natural byproduct of the tradition itself.
I was just about to say, because of the current state of world affairs, this demand to understand what Islam is, has increased, and hence a demand for experts like yourself has increased as well. So maybe perhaps you have made a good career choice out of this.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Actually, the first few years, well, first decade I was out of graduate school, there were very few jobs in Islam, in religious studies departments. And it took trouble in the Middle East in 9/11 to generate lots of interest, and jobs started to pop up after that. I think that's unfortunate. It's like after 9/11 in the U.S., the sales of the Quran exploded, as if somehow reading the Quran is going to provide you with insight into why people went about the atrocities on 9/11. That's not the place to find that out. I guess we should be thankful, or I should be thankful as a scholar of Islam, that there is interest. But what that means is you're working up against a lot of preconceived notions that people have gotten from any number of different forums, media. There are some, online forums and also news channels that seem to be conflating Muslims and Islam with violence. And so I think there are some perceptions out there, and some of my students do have them. And it takes a while, and I have to say that I'm not always successful in getting them to try to understand the tradition in different terms.
Can you blame this on the media then? Is this how much of it is the fault of the media for distorting or giving this false perception of the religion? And in talking to your students, what are the biases that comes true, and how does it come across?
Well, I don't know if I'd blame it on the media. That's an easy target. Media, whatever its form, even radio, often focuses on what's in the news. And we don't typically focus on feel-good stories, although there are some news reports in the U.S. that sometimes do that. But a lot of it is what's making headlines. And what makes headlines often is conflict, violence. And unfortunately, the Middle East has seen its share of that. I don't know if I'd blame it on that. I think that one can run into a very similar problem, even in the Middle East, of Middle Easterners. What do they know about the U.S.? And they know about the U.S. through U.S. foreign policy, and not necessarily by knowing about American society, American culture. And that doesn't give them a full picture of what's going on. So I think we all tend to understand the world from our particular corner of it, and what that means for many Americans who never grew up meeting a Muslim, knowing a Muslim, is that Muslims are these people they see on the news, and many of the people you see on the news are the ones who are committing these acts of violence, and that's not a very insightful way to get to know the other.
Your first book is about a group of Muslim rebels in Islamic history known as the Kharijites. And in your introduction, you were saying how every student in the Introduction to Islam course would come across the Kharijites. Who are the Kharijites?
Well, they're often viewed as the first Islamic sectarian group that emerged in the early 7th century, or the midpoint of the 7th century. And they are very well known within the tradition for being perpetrators of violence, for their particular view of the leadership of early Islam, and for their attacks on fellow Muslims who they didn't believe were pure enough, for their willingness to try to remove leaders from office for committing sins of some kind, errors of some kind that they disagreed with. So they have an image as being rebels against the establishment, against what are regarded as legitimate leaders, and that image has stuck. It's in the early sources. So I think most people who would study early Islam would learn about the Khawarij, the Kharijites, the Shia, and the Sunni as the early emerging sectarian groups, the mainstream groups that, or put it this way, Sunnis often will define themselves over and against both the Khawarij or the Kharijites and the Shia. So these early groups wind up becoming the fodder for what later becomes mainstream, or what many take to be mainstream Islam. There are no real living remnants of the Kharijites, except for a subsect, a group of people in Oman called the Ibadi, the Ibadiyya, and where they dominate in modern-day Oman. And there are some few, there are some groupings also in North Africa. But the Kharijites as an actual sectarian group have not survived into the modern period. But the image of them, the idea of them, and the way people think about them and then use this name against modern groups, that has survived.
And what are its modern incarnations?
Well, put it this way, the way that the name gets used against groups, and this is an intentional interpretive act on the part of people, is typically against Islamist groups. Often, more often than not, militant groups, radical groups, but sometimes moderate Islamists too, when they get kind of painted with the same broad brushstroke of anybody who is fostering a political Islam is sometimes, in some people's viewed as a moderate, rather as a radical. So, and because Kharijites are viewed as militants and overly zealous rebels of some kind, in some cases, the Islamist groups like the Society of Muslim Brothers, but even more so, spin-off groups from that group in Egypt, from the Society of Muslim Brothers in Egypt, that became more militant as they tried to fight against authoritarian rule and establish their view of what Islam should be in modern Egypt, they were often labeled as Kharijites. It's a theological term, really, but it has political import, because the way the early leaders in 7th, 8th, 9th century dealt with them was to fight them and eliminate them. And I think in the modern period, this is often how the term is used too, as kind of a legitimizing tool that these people are radicals. They're not good Muslims because they don't respect others and because they accuse fellow Muslims of not really being Muslims. And when that happens, what you've got is a recipe for violence.
I'm speaking today to Professor Jeffrey Kenny. He is a professor of religious studies. Up next, I'll ask him what is happening in the Middle East and what led to the rise of the Islamic State on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. If you've just joined us on the show today, we have Professor Jeffrey Kenny. He is the professor of religious study at DePaul University. Before we left off, we were talking about his background and also about his book, Muslim Rebels, Kharijites and the Politics of Extremism in Egypt. How are we to understand what's happening in the Middle East and the threat of the Islamic State? Would it ever reach Southeast Asia? In fact, actually, it has reached in terms of recruits.
Right.
A lot of recruits are coming from this part of the world.
Yeah, I think it's reached everywhere, to be honest. It's there are no borders anymore. This is a global problem, both in terms of drawing on Muslims, disaffected Muslims, disenfranchised Muslims from different places for a variety of reasons. I don't think it's even possible to type this. Individuals who seem to be reacting to both their home circumstances and what's happening in the Muslim world and thinking that somehow going to Iraq and Syria, going to IS, is going to be the answer to their to life meaning for them in some way, or to give their lives meaning in some way. So I think this is really something that we'll probably be studying for the next 10 to 20 years to sort out why so many young people especially have been motivated to kind of give up their lives and do this. Because I don't really think most of them know what they're getting into. They know they might be having some personal issues. They might be looking for direction of some kind. But whether this is the direction that they actually wanted to head in, I don't think they probably know this half the time until they get there. And then it's perhaps too late. So I think as far as Southeast Asia is concerned, is obviously there are people who have been turned on to this and who have decided to go to the region and to dedicate their lives to this. I think this is pretty much confined to the Middle East right now in terms of the actual fighting. And given the fact that there's now this coalition force, I think over time you'll see that they're, as they spread, and there are obviously there are these groups that have now joined up both in Libya, in Egypt, Nigeria. Boko Haram has in theory now declared that they are a province. So the Islamic State is looking to expand by looking for other radicalized groups in other places who might not otherwise be affiliated with them to join up, And I think other groups are joining for the same reason some groups joined Al-Qaeda in the past, is that they see this as an opportunity to up their profile and to join part of a larger entity that has gotten such world attention, that it's a way to drive this, again, in almost a kind of global jihadist sense, that it's spreading without really spreading. It just kind of pops up. So this has caused, obviously, it's caused lots of problems in individual states, and it makes it seem as if, and not just because it's a seeming, it seems it's a reality now, that states have lost control of their sovereignty. They don't control their territory anymore. There are parts of it that are, some countries are in civil war. Clearly, Libya is in that circumstance. You might say Yemen is in the same situation. Obviously, Syria and Iraq. Egypt has serious problems in the Sinai, and if it starts spreading out of the Sinai and moving into cities along the Nile, it's going to be even more of concern. And the West is involved, not only because they have some of their own citizens who have gone abroad, Europeans and people from the U.S., but also because they see their interests being jeopardized. Stability in the Middle East, one could say stability in the Middle East is needed for stability in the West, economically at least, but also in terms of other larger geopolitical interests. And right now, it's anything but stable. And not to mention the fact that the U.S. has its hands in a lot of the foreign policy issues that have led to the emergence of ISIS, including what you could say is the failed state of modern Iraq. The invasion of Iraq destroyed the country. We left thinking that, you know, democratic elections were going to put the country aright. But once you have taken the thing apart, like we participated in taking it apart, creating a new sectarian dimension of this with the Shia in charge now as opposed to the Sunnis in the past, it's going to take decades. And we might actually see the redrawing of the map of the Middle East. Maybe not along the lines that IS is hoping to do, but it's difficult to see how Syria can actually be put back together. It's difficult to see how Iraq could be put back together. We might see the emergence of a new Sunni nation state that includes parts of eastern Syria and western Iraq, which would be, in some ways, it would fit into IS's agenda of undoing the borders of the Middle East that were created by Western powers. But I think that is their goal. But I think eventually the IS will wind up being pushed out. But I don't think that you're ever going to do away with the extremism that's there unless you deal with some of the fundamental problems that are impacting Middle Eastern societies.
I want to come back to this quote that you wrote in the introduction to Muslim Rebels. You said that we are still too close, this is back in 2006, we are still too close to 9/11 and too engaged in the war on terror to make a final judgment about whether power will ultimately subvert American knowledge about Islamic terrorism. What did you mean by this, and do we have a better knowledge of what's going on now?
I think we have a fairly good sense of at least how the U.S. and other powers got themselves involved in the problem, and how I will just say, speaking specifically as a person from the U.S., how the U.S. contributed to this, both in terms of empowering jihadism, not knowing at the time that once it got out of control, there was no way of controlling it. I think it's pretty safe to say that the result of bringing in all these fighters from the Middle East, supplying them with money and weaponry through Pakistan and through the help of Saudi Arabia also, is that we created something of a monster, or at least we participated in creating this. Some of the people who went there who were fighting what they thought was the good jihad were probably well motivated. Others were militants from their home Middle Eastern countries and from other places, who went there because it was hard to engage in a jihad in their home country because they were being cracked down on by governments who were not tolerating Islamist activity. So places like Egypt, Syria, and others, they were glad to see these Islamists leave and go to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. But then the war is over, they're successful, and they see that success as a validation of their cause. Many went home, but the ones who stayed on, who wind up creating Al-Qaeda, they have been essentially preying on and trying to create chaos in order to spread this. Global jihadism is not something that's really located in secure nation states. Nation states that have a stable government, that have a stable economy, these are groups that seemingly are able to thrive where there are failing or failed states. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate that in some cases Western policy created some of that failure. So I think we know that. We just don't know what to do about it. Too much intervention has obviously created problems. No intervention, it's hard not to intervene, especially when people in the region ask you to. I'm not defending U.S. policy here. There's really no defense of it. It is a mess. It's a real mess. But at this point in time, it's hard to stand by, I think, for many Western powers. It's hard to stand by and see the whole region fall apart. So what are the responsibilities for this, right? I mean, are you responsible for continuing to try to do something to try to lift these countries out of the condition that they're in, both in terms of the radicalism, but also the kind of, I would say, failed politics in these countries? Most of them are authoritarian, and unfortunately the U.S. has been supportive of this. We have promoted and provided funding for leaders who were not really representing their people, and who were often suppressing dissent, suppressing voices of opposition, and they still are, unfortunately. So I don't think the West is responsible for these problems, but it certainly, we've contributed to them. And how one sorts that out, the blame, the ultimate blame, is, I'll leave that to someone else.
It's almost like the two parties are coming in at different approaches, because the West is trying to prop up this concept of nation states, the lines of trying to prop up governments to administer them, whereas religious terrorists, you coined this term cosmic war, that they're fighting for a war of the afterlife.
Right.
So I guess when you have two opposing goals like this, then it's hard to come to agreement or peace.
Right.
The definition of winning is different. So I guess,
sure.
Yeah. But moving on to your latest book that you co-edited, Islam in the Modern World. Modernity is often associated with enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution in the West. What does it mean to be modern in the Islamic world?
Well, I certainly don't think that the Enlightenment, at least not in its big E European sense, Enlightenment, is what the Muslim world took as a model or is taking as a model. In fact, in some ways, I think it's, at least more recently, it's counter to that. I think many Muslim societies, at least the people who are trying to shape them, intellectuals for the most part, would like to try to carve out a modernity that is somehow compatible with Muslim society, Muslim culture, Muslim thinking, and not something that is borrowed wholesale from the West. And that's quite understandable. There has been quite a bit of bringing in what is taken to be Western values or Western ideas, Western laws. But this is both a debating point of whether these things are really Western or whether they are universal. Is nationalism Western, or is it just a fact of modern political life? Is capitalism Western, or is this an economic mode that has taken over everywhere? I don't think anyone owns these ideas, and no one is just defining them on their own. Most countries are trying to sort out what kind of nationalism they're going to have, what's the role of religion in the nation state. Most countries work this out on their own. I have to say, in many cases, Muslim societies have not found a way to do this, and in part they haven't done it because often this has been imposed from the top down by people who took over the country and then had a design plan for how they were going to use religion, often to rule and to use the legitimacy of religion to justify their own political ends. So the people themselves have not had that much say in this. But I think modernity is something that's shared. I mean, it is industrialization, it is technology, it is, all those things are global now. I mean, we're all united by those things, and in some cases they control us as much as we control them. And in that sense, I don't think there's really that much difference between any area of the world that is trying to modernize But I guess it depends on what you mean, whether we're dealing with technology, whether we're dealing with industrialization, whether we're dealing with economic self-sufficiency, or whether we're dealing with a certain set of cultural values that seem to be adopted from elsewhere. Right. I mean, does every country that's modern, does their society need to look like the U.S.? And I don't think that's true at all.
Right. To end with American politics, every election cycle, a candidate's religion always becomes an issue. And do you see it playing more of a major role, or is it going to go the way of Europe, where it becomes increasingly a non-factor?
Well, personally, I'd like to see it become a non-factor, but I doubt whether that's going to happen. The U.S.'s religiosity levels are parallel, one might argue, with the Middle East or with India. They're high. And they are, this has been the kind of, it's anomalous in terms of other Western nations. So I don't think that's ever going to, this isn't going to change. This has been happening, you know, throughout my lifetime. We have no religious test for office. There is a separation of religion and state, technically, but you can't keep people's personal religious views out of the voting booth. I know there are some people who suggest that one needs to do that, but I think when people make choices for candidates, they often draw on the deepest recesses of their values, and they want to put people in office who they think they can trust. And often that means putting in office someone who looks and seems to be like them. We could say that's improper, that you should have a more open mind, but I think that's the reality, and I don't think that's just peculiar to America. I think that's probably true everywhere. It would be hard for me to to see a future where a Buddhist, a Hindu, or a Muslim would be elected president of the U.S. We've had one Catholic president. Everyone else has been Protestant. So we even have a rather narrow aperture of Christianity that's there. Could we have a Jewish president? As far as I'm concerned, sure, but I don't see this happening. Right? It's just not. It doesn't seem to be happening. And to the extent that people of those religious backgrounds get involved, well, I put it this way: I think there's probably a lot of serious consideration about people who would be willing to run for office who would come from these backgrounds. I think the U.S. would have to change quite a bit for this to seem viable. I think many people were somewhat surprised because we've had a Mormon candidate, right? When Romney was running, and in the minds of many Christians, Mormons are not Christians, right? So there are still some bias issues about whether Mormons are really coming out of Christianity. For other people, they're just another Christian denomination. But it's certainly the case that Romney was one of the things that was influencing not just his candidacy to run, but the perception of him. And the closer people who aren't in the mainstream come to look like they're going to be a successful candidate, I think this is when these issues get raised. And in that case, it's cultural bias, but it's also cultural bias that it's often politicized, too.
On that note, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Professor Jeffrey Kenny, Professor of Religious Study at DePaul University, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.